On the show today, NATO prepares for a summit and Joe Biden manages Ukraine's expectations.
I don't think there is unanimity in NATO about whether or not to bring Ukraine into the NATO family now.
Plus, Benjamin Netanyahu appears to be growing impatient at protesters.
On Sunday, calling on his attorney general to attend a cabinet meeting for a grilling on police countermeasures to the protests. As the meeting began, Israeli media carried leaked quotes of some ministers calling for her to quit.
And later, Cambodians head to the polls and a look at the center of the arts world for Ukrainians, Belarusians, and Russian exiles. Today is Monday, July 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. The latest from Israel in a few minutes. First, though, as NATO members prepare for their upcoming summit in Vilnius, the U.S. has again justified its decision to send cluster bombs to Ukraine. And the chances of Kyiv joining NATO anytime soon aren't looking good. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias has more.
As explosives that release smaller submunitions, cluster bombs can kill indiscriminately. More than 100 countries have banned them. But as Ukraine is running out of inventory in its counteroffensive against Russia, the United States has now agreed to send them some, explained the White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby on ABC's This Week show.
We're going to send these additional artillery shells that have cluster bomblets in them to help bridge the gap as we ramp up production of normal 155 artillery shells.
The Russian government, who has been accused itself of using cluster munitions in urban areas of Ukraine, condemned the move. Human rights advocates have underlined the dangers that cluster munitions pose to civilians. Democratic Representative Barbara Lee echoed similar concerns on CNN.
They don't always immediately explode. Children can step on them. That's a line we should not cross.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, interviewed on ABC, once again raised the importance of receiving international support in the form of diverse weaponry.
F-16 or any other equipment that we do need will give us an opportunity to move faster, to save more lives, to stand our ground for a longer time.
Zelensky added that he would like to get clear security guarantees from NATO when its members meet in Vilnius, Lithuania. U.S. President Joe Biden, who appeared on CNN, lowered expectations that Ukraine would join the military alliance anytime soon.
I don't think there is unanimity in NATO about whether or not to bring Ukraine into the NATO family now, at this moment, in the middle of a war. NATO is a process that takes some time to meet all the qualifications, and from democratization to a whole range of other issues.
Republican Representative Michael McCaul expressed similar views on CNN.
They've demonstrated a will to fight, a will for freedom and democracy against tyranny and oppression. I think they've earned it, but we have to put it on the right path forward, not an immediate ascension into NATO.
Discussions on how to bring Kyiv closer to joining the alliance are expected to take place during the NATO summit. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. Treasury Secretary on Sunday finished her four-day trip to China. The visit aimed to ease tension between the two countries as the relationship has taken a recent downturn. The two sides talked economics, a spy balloon, and climate change. But what came of it? VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the story.
A recent maneuver in the Taiwan Strait by a Chinese warship passing a U.S. Navy destroyer in what the United States called an unsafe manner highlighted the tensions between the world's largest superpowers. It was against this backdrop that U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen visited the Chinese capital late last week. In Beijing, she met with parties to discuss issues ranging from trade, the environment, and spying. There appears to have been some progress, but Yellen said the two countries still have a way to go. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen speaking in Beijing as provided by the Associated Press.
The U.S. and China have significant disagreements. those disagreements need to be communicated clearly and directly. But President Biden and I do not see the relationship between the U.S. and China through the frame of great power conflict. We believe that the world is big enough for both of our countries to thrive.
Yellen's trip follows the Chinese spy balloon incident from earlier this year, where a high-altitude balloon traveled much of the United States and Canada. The U.S. ultimately shot down the craft, and the Chinese government called that an excessive reaction, a topic of discussion brought up by new Chinese Vice Premier Hala Feng at a meeting last week with Yellen.
It is regretful that due to a series of unexpected incidents, such as the airship, the China-U.S. relations have had some difficulties, particularly in implementing the consensus of the two state leaders. We wish the U.S. side would take a rational and practical attitude, meet with the Chinese side halfway, and put positive remarks into actions so as to stabilize and improve China-U.S. relations.
Yellen also met to discuss what she called honest lines of communication, particularly around climate issues. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen again speaking from Beijing as provided by the Associated Press.
As the two largest economies in the world, it's in our interest to work together on these challenges, and it's something the world expects of us. And climate change is on the top of the list of global challenges. And the United States and China must work together to address this existential threat.
While a major diplomatic breakthrough wasn't expected by either country, Yellen's visit came amid a particularly turbulent time in relations. The Wall Street Journal reported last month that China had reached a secret deal with Cuba to establish an electronic eavesdropping station capable of gathering information from the southeastern United States. Further compounding issues recently was when U.S. President Joe Biden called Chinese President Xi Jinping a dictator. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appears to be growing impatient at the protests against his government's proposed policies and the police response to them. Reuters' Gillian Kitchener reports.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu signaled impatience with resurgent demonstrations against his plan to overhaul the justice system. On Sunday, calling on his attorney general to attend a cabinet meeting for a grilling on police countermeasures to the protests. As the meeting began, Israeli media carried leaked quotes of some ministers calling for her to quit. Netanyahu said both opponents and supporters of the justice system reform have the right to demonstrate peacefully, but
while the government has not considered restricting this right, it is requested to receive a report on what is the enforcement policy regarding violations of the law that infringe on the basic rights of millions of citizens and which are carried out almost on a daily basis during the demonstrations.
Street protests have flared and protesters plan to converge near Israel's main airport as parliament debates the bill on Monday. That's when Netanyahu's religious nationalist coalition is due to bring, for its first ratification reading, a bill that would limit reasonableness as a standard of judicial review. Critics say the bill's passage would open the door for abuses of power. But Netanyahu, who is on trial on graft charges he denies, says the aim is to restore balance among branches of government.
That's Reuters' Gillian Kitchener reporting. And here are some of the other stories we're following from around the world. Syria's information ministry has canceled the BBC's media accreditation, accusing the British public broadcaster of biased and fake news in its coverage of the war-torn country. Hundreds of people lined the streets of Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia, on Sunday as a truck carrying 30 coffins passed on its way to Srebrenica, where the newly identified victims of Europe's only acknowledged genocide since World War II will be buried on the anniversary of the massacre. A U.S. airstrike has killed an Islamic State leader in eastern Syria, the U.S. Central Command said on Sunday. And voters in Uzbekistan cast their ballots on Sunday in an election that's widely expected to extend the incumbent's rule by 7 more years. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers with the James Webb Space Telescope Cosmic Evolution Early Release Science Survey have discovered the most distant active supermassive black hole to date. The black hole is in a galaxy identified as Sears 1019 that was formed about 13.23 billion years ago, just over 570 million years after the Big Bang. The black hole, at 9 million solar masses, is not as enormous as any other that have been identified by other telescopes in the early universe. These other early supermassive black holes usually have masses that are more than a billion times that of the Sun. Scientists theorize that there are many of these supermassive black holes in the early universe, but were too dim to observe until the powerful JWST was put online. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. Warsaw, Poland has become a cultural hotspot for Ukrainians, Belarusians, and Russian exiles. We'll go there shortly. Now to Cambodia, where the 7th national election takes place on July 23rd. 18 political parties are registered for the vote to elect members to the National Assembly. But because 17 of the 18 have little funding and few followers, the ruling Cambodian People's Party is likely to take all the seats and form a new government. Many international organizations consider the vote a sham. VOA's Chetra Chap reports.
Some 9.7 million Cambodians, roughly 55% of the population, are expected to vote on July 23rd in a national election that lacks credible opposition to the ruling Cambodian People's Party, or CPP. Its leader, Prime Minister Hun Sen, known as Samdak, has ruled for nearly 40 years by silencing opposing politicians, activists, and journalists through jail or exile. Most recently, his threats prompted Meta's Content Oversight Board to recommend a six-month freeze on his Facebook page. The Prime Minister promptly banned its board members from Cambodia. Cambodia's 18 registered political parties began campaigning on July 1st. The government banned its biggest opponent, the Candlelight Party, for misfiling paperwork. When Candlelight supporters called for an election boycott, the government amended election laws. Now anyone who fails to vote cannot run in future elections. Kim Su Pirit is a spokesperson for the Candlelight Party.
This election is like a soup without salt. It's not going to be delicious. The real value of this election is not good. It only looks good on the surface.
Officials and candidates of the former Cambodian National Rescue Party, or CNRP, now lead Candlelight. After a CNRP show of force in the 2017 local commune council elections, the party was dissolved by the courts before the last national vote in 2018. Aung Samad is monitoring manager for the Cambodian League for the Promotion and Defense of Human Rights.
Unavoidably, there will be criticism on the political freedom and on the single party National Assembly, like in 2018, which doesn't have checks and balances.
The United States and the European Union says they want the CPP to open the election to all parties. CPP spokesperson Sok Aisan told VOA Khmer that the ruling party doesn't care if results are not recognized. He said many countries called the 2018 election fake but accepted the government formed after the vote. Hun Sen has said he is planning to exit his political career in 2028. His son, Hun Manet, a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy West Point, is his likely successor. He is running for a National Assembly seat, one of the 12 representing the capital city of Phnom Penh. If he and the CPP win, he will be eligible to become prime minister in the new government. Chetra Chap, VOA News, Washington.
Friday marked 100 days since Russian authorities detained Evan Gershkovich and charged him with espionage, the first U.S. journalist to be accused of this since the Cold War. The Kremlin has hinted this week, though, that it would be open to negotiating a prisoner swap. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
100 days behind bars. Evan Gershkovich, the Russia correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, was arrested on March 29th in Yekaterinburg, east of Moscow. Russian authorities charged the 31-year-old American citizen with espionage, accusing him of gathering information about a defense company that was a state secret. Gershkovich and his newspaper strongly deny the charges. He's being held in Moscow's notorious Lefortovo prison and faces up to 20 years in jail if convicted. There may be a glimmer of hope. Russia confirmed this week that there had been contact between it and the US about a potential prisoner swap, which could potentially involve Gershkovich and Vladimir Dunayev, a Russian citizen in US custody on cybercrime charges. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said, "We have said that there are certain contacts with the United States on this matter, but we do not want to make them public in any way. The talks must be carried out and continued in complete silence," he said. Russia had said there could be no exchange involving Gershkovich until a verdict was reached in his case. No trial date has been announced. His pre-trial detention has been extended to August. The US ambassador has called on Russia to release him.
The charges against him are baseless. He is an innocent journalist who was carrying out journalistic activities and has been wrongfully detained. Such hostage diplomacy is unacceptable, and we call on the Russian Federation to release him.
The U.S. Embassy has accused Russia of illegally restricting access to Gershkovich in jail. Moscow said Thursday this was a retaliatory measure. Maria Zakharova, a spokeswoman for the Russian Foreign Ministry, said, "When the visas have been denied to the Russian media, who were supposed to cover the Russian presidency of the UN Security Council in April this year, the decision was made to postpone the visit of American diplomats to Gershkovich." Press freedom has declined sharply in Russia since its 2022 invasion of Ukraine, according to the organization Reporters Without Borders. Russia ranked 164th out of 180 countries in its 2023 Press Freedom Index. Anton Orek is a Russian journalist based in Moscow. He told VOA, "There is certainly no journalistic work going on in Moscow now, in the full sense of this word. There are just employees of media outlets, the official mass media, that keep working under the conditions of military censorship, with all those restrictions that were imposed already last year, where we are not allowed to use certain words or touch on some particular subjects." Foreign journalists in Russia had enjoyed greater freedoms than their Russian counterparts. Analysts say the arrest of Evan Gershkovich will likely prompt many foreign media organizations to re-evaluate their operations in Russia. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And now to Warsaw, where Yulia Krivich has created a burgeoning community of artists from around the former Soviet Union, helping to turn the Polish capital into a major hub of creative talent, especially after Russia launched its full-scale invasion of neighboring Ukraine. Reuters' Olivia Chan reports.
Warsaw has become a major hub of creative talent for artists from around the former Soviet Union. Yulia Krivich is from Ukraine and has lived in Poland for more than a decade. She now organizes exhibitions, workshops, and other events at Warsaw's Museum of Modern Art, aiming to confront what she sees as the collective trauma of Russian colonialism.
I'm really happy to be and live in Warsaw. I live in Poland because I don't have to explain basic things. I don't have to deal with this feeling of helplessness every day because everyone here understands what's going on.
So
this is such a very important fact that I think attracts people too. A lot of my friends from Kyrgyzstan, Ukraine, or Belarus feel close mentally, culturally, and ideologically.
Even before Russian troops poured into Ukraine in 2022, Poland had been hosting thousands of migrants from the east. People fled from a Moscow-backed uprising in eastern Ukraine and turmoil in Belarus. One of them is Marina Daszak, who has worked as a theatre producer in Poland since 2013. It was after the crushing of anti-government protests in Belarus in 2020 that she focused on working with fellow Belarusian artists. She said it was Russian-born playwright and director Ivan Perepayev who proposed producing a play with Belarusian actors when artists started fleeing to Poland. That was the start of the play 1.8M, which refers to the space available to individuals in overcrowded Belarusian prisons. Its director, Perepayev, was arrested in May by a Moscow court in absentia for spreading fake news about the Russian army.
I generally think that this is a chance for Poland, a chance that should not be missed, and it's a friendly opening up. Not to be a closed country, but to open up and build an even more interesting one space for dialogue on this.
The director has now launched a new project in Warsaw, Teal House. It is staffed by Ukrainian and Belarusian refugees and offers activities ranging from drama and music performances to yoga and trauma healing.
That was Olivia Chan of Reuters reporting for us. And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, visit us online at voanews.com and follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In March 2011, military forces under the command of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad began a series of brutal attacks against peaceful pro-democracy protesters. Since then, more than 500,000 Syrians have been killed and tens of thousands have disappeared. Some of the missing were arrested by the Syrian government and remain in prison, while others were kidnapped by groups that were not affiliated with the government, and some have died or have been killed and are perhaps buried in one of the mass graves that have been found on both sides of the battle lines. More than 12 years ago, the Syrian people peacefully rose up to demand their freedom and dignity, calling for Damascus to respect their inalienable rights and to stop human rights violations, said United States Acting Deputy Representative to the United Nations, Jeffrey De Laurentiis. Yet this conflict continues with devastating consequences for the Syrian people.
Today, there are estimates that more than 155,000 Syrians are missing. Many of them unjustly detained or disappeared by parties to the conflict in Syria. These include individuals believed to be missing at the hands of Daesh and other terrorist groups.
Nearly every Syrian family is affected by this issue. Despite concerted efforts and significant diplomacy in the past 12 years, there has been limited progress on this protracted issue, said Ambassador De Laurentiis.
Confirming the fate and whereabouts of the missing, securing their release, and returning the remains of those who perished to their families is a moral and humanitarian imperative. People deserve to know the truth about their missing loved ones. This is essential to promoting lasting stability, durable peace, and a sustainable political solution to the Syrian conflict.
On June 29th, the UN General Assembly voted to form an independent international institution to search for Syria's missing in both government and opposition-held areas. This entity will collect information from families, Syrian civil society organizations, international organizations, and through inquiries to both sides of the conflict. This resolution is humanitarian in nature. It is focused on all missing Syrians, regardless of ethnicity, religion, or political affiliation, said Ambassador De Laurentiis. We hope all parties to the conflict will cooperate with this body and release all unjustly detained people, clarifying the fate of those who are missing, and return the remains of those who have perished to their families.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.